You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
What is this week? This is week three of Hot Bill Summer.
This is week two in this spot.
And this vacation destination.
Right. But this is not vacation. This is doing work in another place with screaming children and deadlines.
It's still Hot Bill Summer.
but we're having a good time. And it's been I've been productive this week. I've got a lot of copy up.
And who knows, Bill? It could be that changing scenery, you know, spurs some creativity and the writing juices start flowing.
But you, you know, you've never been a Biden diehard by any stretch. You didn't vote for him in the general.
Ride or die.
And you sort of had a fair amount of criticism of Biden over the course of the last 7 months. But I feel like your Biden opposition has really hit a maximum point with what happened with Afghanistan. Is that fair to say?
The Biden meter has shifted. I have to say, there are a lot of people sort of in the never Trump camp who this is the first time that they've been critical of Biden. You know what I mean? I've criticized Biden the whole time because I think it's part of my job, just like my job was to criticize Trump when he was wrong, which was pretty often. what is it about inflicting the, you know, what's the line? The powerful
inflicting the powerful.
Whatever the cliche is.
Right.
But I do have to admit, Bill, this time when I was that, especially the speech. Now we have the images of Afghans clinging to airplanes and falling to their death and all that. It's horrific. But I thought Biden would come out and turn on the Uncle Joe charm. And really, Biden can make it almost impossible, even if he does something really horrific and it's stupid. That's just Joe. He doesn't mean anything by it. This time, Bill, Biden came out in that speech a couple days ago. He was defiant. He was casting blame to other people, to the Afghans, to the leaders, and to his predecessor. And that is really the first time that I, you know, my criticism of Biden up until now, I think, has been mostly like constructive criticism. This time I felt like he kind of pissed me off. And I wonder if I'm alone in that. But I do have to say, I think he it really undermines the two things that Biden delivered. One was competence, the idea that he would be competent compared to Trump. Well, that's gone. Certainly in this instance, it's gone. And the other thing was his callousness. I mean, he really seemed just dismissive and callous. And that's very off-brand for what Joe Biden had promised up until now.
Well, there's a whole lot of things to say on this whole subject. I mean, I don't know if you're in this camp, Matt. I wouldn't think you are, but I think a lot of never Trump Republicans were so for foreign policy reasons that Trump was a America First nationalist, and you know the Bill Kristols of the world are interventionists, and you know Biden was never a full on neocon, but definitely more interventionist than Trump, and arguably more than even maybe the median Democrat. Although I think there's a pretty long history of Democratic interventionism, so. Yeah, but the thing is, Biden's foreign policy vision is not so simplistic. I mean, he's always been an Afghan skeptic. That record that goes back a long way. So you can't easily put him in he's definitely an internationalist and an interventionist, but it's not in every circumstance.
I don't really know what Biden's foreign policy worldview is, mm-hmm. except that he's been wrong about almost everything.
Well, that's the Bob Gates knock that he keeps making.
It's true. If you go through, and even sometimes he's wrong. Like, you know, he was for invading Iraq, bad idea, but against the surge, bad idea. You know, like he's like same thing with like with the Persian Gulf, right? He was against it, turned out to be a smashing success. Then he criticized Bush, 41, for not going to Baghdad and toppling Hussein, which would have been, you know, as we later found out, a bad idea. So his instincts seem to be very bad. And he clearly overruled the military brass on this one.
Well, I'm not going to do a point-by-point defense of Biden so that I don't feel competent or steeped enough in the issue to do it, and I think that's really on him to do. So I'll let that lie, and there's certainly room for criticism there. I mean, I don't think Biden's foreign policy record is infallible. To the competency,
there's also weird stuff. Bill, I'm sorry, but there's also weird stuff. Like I was just looking back because I'm writing something about this today. I was looking back at a political article from April. About how Biden was overruling the military brass. And there's a quote in there where Biden says something like, and I'm paraphrasing here, I apologize, but it's something like, you know, they want us to stay in Afghanistan for women's rights. And the idea that I'm going to send my son over, he's talking about like Bo or something, like, that I'm going to like lose my son for that. He says weird stuff.
Well, it's on. I mean, it's not like that. It's I wouldn't say it's weird. It's unvarnished. It certainly is going to be off-putting if you believe that we should be doing everything possible to protect Afghanistan women's rights. And there's certainly people like that out there. People like that inside the Democratic base. But there's also a view in the Democratic base, perhaps the majority of the Democratic base, that. That's not a good enough reason to put American troops on the line. That we can't solve all the world's problems militarily, that often military action creates more problems than it solves. And we need to find other ways to try to advance those kinds of goals. And there's some Democrats that are just, you know, more isolationist completely, saying, look, it's just not our problem in any respect.
Well, this is on the right and the left. They want to wash their hands of all that. But the interesting thing, though, what I think is so funny now is to talk about welcoming the Taliban into the international community, and that the international community could apply, you know, soft power pressure on the Taliban because they really want to be respected. Like, come on.
Well, I just don't know. I'm not an Afghanistan expert. I don't know what kind of conversations they've had. I have no idea it's not like my gut is to trust the Taliban. It's not. But weird things happen. So, you know, I'm not
saying you're not an expert, Bill. And I just want to. So, first of all, I'm not an expert on healthcare. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually like I write about stuff all the time that I'm not an expert on, but I am a student of, and I am, I pay attention, and I'm an American, and I try to learn about these things, and I interview people, but I'm not an expert.
Mm-hmm. Well,
But you know what? The experts get it wrong a lot, and the experts are divided. So I don't think that's
I'm not saying you're not allowed to talk about it if you're a pundit. Yeah, but I'm loathed to start getting on my high horse when I haven't even written about the subject in, you know, probably the entirety of the 20-year occupation. I mean, I've never done a standalone Afghanistan piece. I haven't done the legwork to study up and try to understand all these nuances as best as an outsider can. I think there's value from outsider perspective, and I try to give that a lot of things. I haven't done it in Afghanistan. So this whole notion that, you know, bad thing happens and all of a sudden I'm an instant expert, like that makes me uncomfortable. So I don't personally want to go there. And I just don't feel like I'm loath to be a clairvoyant, even when I do know a fair amount on the subject. This is so unusual, and there's so much volatility there that I would, even if I was an expert, I'd be careful saying I know what's going to happen in 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. It's very notable that the Taliban is trying to put forth this image of law and order. You know, they're not, as far as I know, correct me if I'm missing something, they're not rounding up the Americans trying to get out and like throwing them in prisons or executing them or trying to exact retribution on Afghanis, at least today. Maybe they're going to stay.
Wait a second on that one. Yeah. You're right about the Americans, as far as I know. Yeah. But let me pull up here. I think our friend Josh Krausar just tweeted something out from the New York Times. Let me see if I can pull it up quickly and quote it. You know how it is with the internet. Man, he tweets a lot. He tweets a lot. I'll let you talk and I'll find it. How about
that? Well, it's just, so that's why I'm not jumping in and being very definitive about what I think is going to happen next. But I want to bring to a point you said about competency.
Yes.
Which is, it's very tricky to run on competence because it is not possible to be uniformly competent in every respect when you're president. Something's going to go wrong somewhere. You just don't have that level of control over everything. Now, that doesn't mean that Biden is immune to criticism on this subject. If we can make the case that if Biden had a different plan in place to prepare for this contingency and get more Americans and Afghani friends out of Kabul or other parts of Afghanistan in a more efficient way, by all means, do that investigation and criticize where appropriate. But it's always going to be the case that something's going to go wrong somewhere. And I don't think this means that all of a sudden Biden is akin to Trump in every respect, and this is somehow non-upgrade overall because this went sideways. Because there is also the argument that it going sideways is irrelevant to the point that we just shouldn't be there, period. I'm not saying that is my deeply held view, but it is a view. It's clearly Biden's view, and it may well be a majority view. Polling is going to be in a very fluid place right now. But the piece that I wrote at the Washington Monthly yesterday just looked at the polling data from when Reagan pulled out of Lebanon, less than a year after the horrific Beirut barracks bombing, which was the deadliest day in U.S. Marine Corps history. His polls were stable after that pullout, and Biden and Reagan made similar excuses that Biden did. Well, we trained his military, and the military didn't fight. That's not our fault.
All right. So this is where I will let me just jump in. I want to go back to your Washington Monthly piece in a second. But here's what I was talking about. The Taliban, and it's a New York Times piece. Taliban militants are intensifying a search for people they believe worked with U.S. and NATO forces, including among the crowds of Afghans at Kabul's airport, and have threatened to kill or arrest their family members if they cannot find them, according to a confidential U.N. document. So that may
be happening. Obviously would be in character for the Taliban to do that. But there seems to be an attempt on the Taliban's part to not give off that impression in the immediate aftermath.
More propaganda savvy, definitely. That's my take on it.
And so does that indicate a desire for a different relationship with the world? I just don't know.
That I saw today where they're like, make no mistake, we're not bringing democracy. This is Sharia law. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would tend to...
Well, I have no reason not to expect... I mean, they never claimed to be anything but purveyors of Sharia law. So that is fully in expectation. But I don't think we can presume politically that this is going to end up being a net negative for Biden, because I think a lot of Americans didn't have an emotional stake in staying, didn't have an emotional stake in the freedoms of the Afghani people, didn't have an expectation that we're going to stand up true democracy there. And the only thing that they probably would care about is if their terrorist groups can regroup on Afghanistan soil and launch a terrorist attack against us. If that happened...
I would say that's the big one. The other thing is if there are hostages. If there were... this could be somebody doesn't have to be... a top-down decision, but if there were hostages taken or something, because there are thousands of Americans and who are actually there apparently, which is wild. If something like that were to go south as well,
mm-hmm. Do you have more to say on Afghanistan?
Well, I have, you know, I just did a podcast with Bill Kristol, the aforementioned Bill
Kristol. So how mad is Kristol? Because, I mean, here's classic neocon, abandoned Trump for clear foreign policy reasons. This is clearly not what Kristol wants. Is he done with Biden?
That's not the impression I got. The impression I got is he still favors Biden over Trump because Trump is like an existential threat to America and to democracy. But he's being very critical of Biden. But I don't think it's a deal breaker, you know, in terms of the relationship.
Well, I don't think this is indicative of a. I mean, you certainly can make an argument that there is a continuum from Obama to Trump to Biden to be very averse to extended military occupation. So I think there is a, you know, continuum from Obama to Trump to Biden to be very averse to military adventures, extended military occupations, to appeal to that strain of the American electorate that has no interest in being policemen of the world, that kind of thing. But the extent of the application of it for all three of those presidents is inconsistent. Trump has interventions too. Although I think he's the least interventionist of the three. And in the case of Obama and Biden, they don't want to be bogged down that part of the world. They both want that pivot to Asia. They both have China on the brain and really want to put more emphasis in there. And then, of course, the Middle East, you know, keeps tugging them back. So I'm not saying it's going to be a successful pivot. But I think from a Kristol perspective, speak for him, which I know I can't do, I would think you would recognize, you know, Biden's not an American firster. Because of this one decision, he's still more internationalist than a lot of other people, and isn't trying to abandon the global stage. I know there's this knock that Biden says he's going to America's back, and now he does this. I saw one commenter I was on Twitter, and I don't know too much of the person's background, but it seemed to be a cogent point. It's not like the European countries were stamping their feet, demanding we stay up until they're complaining now. Yeah. They're talking trash about Biden now, but where were they 6 months ago when this is all telegraphed? So no one is really wanting to be the leader in staying here, because it's such an intractable problem.
Well, I would say two things. One, in terms of the public opinion, Kristol would say, because he did say, you know, yeah, public opinion's not good, and Americans never are really that into, or rarely are that into, foreign intervention. But there haven't been leaders. I mean, we've had three presidents now who've been talking about getting out of Afghanistan. There hasn't been any president to kind of, you know, eloquently or coherently make the case for why we should stay. So that's number one.
I would just add that quickly. I don't think there's been any outside organization making that case. I mean, where were the stories about Afghan women and girls enjoying their freedoms for the past 20 years that Americans could hear before this point? I mean, you know,
I think that speaks to our media problem, which is it only covers bad news, right?
Well, but Malala had a massive amount of media attention, but I haven't heard any other like stories in years. And so to have a crop up now, you know, I mean, if that was your primary desire and primary interest, then, you know, you got to do something to that end if you want to get the outcome that you want.
Yeah, you could, but I mean, the left and the right are both united in being America first in their own way. I think that the left and the right both don't necessarily think America is that great for different reasons. So we really shouldn't be projecting our values or our power because we're not that great, according to them. And I think both the left and the right think we should be doing nation building at home. And so that's where the energy is. Now, you could argue that like somebody like a Bill Kristol, who's already doing a lot. Bill Kristol has a lot of organizations and a lot of tentacles out there. And I think, you know, one could argue that that his, you know, one, his primary effort was to defeat Donald Trump. But maybe he could have done more to talk about, you know, why we should be in Afghanistan, why it's good that we have a very small footprint that was maintaining order in the country, preventing the Taliban from taking over cities. And of course, we haven't had a terror attack here of the 9/11 scale in 20 years. You can make a good case that it's worth the investment of a small footprint. So that's number one. The other point, though, Bill, is, you know, if Biden is so concerned about China, I mean, I would argue that we have signaled to China and Russia and other regimes that only understand power and strength that we cut and run, that we do not stand by our allies, that we do not that if you just wait long enough, right? And so whether we're talking about what happens to Taiwan or Ukraine or whatever, we have not signaled strength to people like China. And also, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, but like there are a lot of mineral resources in Afghanistan that other regimes may now find a way to exploit.
Well, if I was analyzing the broader import of this, I would be careful not to overextrapolate. I would not interpret this to mean that America always cuts and runs. You know, in the piece that I just wrote, you know, this was sort of a side point. Reagan pulled out of Lebanon, was accused of cutting and running at the time, but not so loudly that he lost re-election. He won re-election very handily, you know, several months after he pulled out. But Osama bin Laden, according to the book The Looming Tower, took that as inspiration, that he would tell the al-Qaeda recruits when they first came to camp that if you deliver two or three sharp blows to the Americans, you know, they'll leave because they don't have the stomach for it. And that led him to do 9/11, which was proved bin Laden's theory completely wrong, because America took a sharp blow and did the exact opposite, occupied Afghanistan for 20 years and killed bin Laden in the process. So I don't think you should assume this means, there's no reason to go gentle on the Americans because they're weak. You can hit the wrong nerve and get a different reaction.
Totally. But you're interpreting it the way a rational American might. And I just think that the way that some of these regimes and some of these, actors think is not rational. And also in a way, and here I'm going to buy into the left and the right. The left and the right in different sort of different ways have this like grudging admiration for the Taliban. And the right would say like they at least believe in something. They have an ethos. They have things that they're willing to die for. Bin Laden, by the way that you tell the story, they got, you know, we got him. We killed him. And so he was wrong, but like maybe he's got a longer time frame or time horizon. Like maybe he really believes in his, you know, perverse ideology or purpose, and he's willing to sacrifice his life for it. And it actually transcends the last 20 years.
Well, you know, you're making the Bill Maher point now.
We have retreated, and so he was right in a way.
Well, you know, the Bin Laden desire was to get Americans out of the entire region, which is not the case. We still have our bases. We're not in Afghanistan now, but we're in plenty of other places there. And I don't think that's going to change. If Taliban or al-Qaeda or whatever, you know, your job is not completed, and I doubt it ever will be completed, because we're going to maintain a counterterrorism strategy that involves a military presence in that region for, you know, the indefinite future.
Wouldn't it be nice to have Bagram Air Base if we're going to be over there?
You know,
one
thing that struck me is, I think it was in Woodward's book that covered Obama's Afghanistan decision and Biden's pushback on the generals there. And apparently Biden's argument was, well, we're still going to have Bagram and Kandahar, so we're still going to be able to do counterterrorism operations. And now today that's not the case. So I am curious, what is Biden's strategy for counterterrorism operations without having any military presence in Afghanistan at all? I honestly don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, if I was a reporter in a press conference about it, that's what I would ask.
All right. There's no lack of Afghanistan commentary, but I'll tell you what is lacking, Bill. It's your insight into domestic politics.
Well, let me tell you something. I want to show this a little quickly because I'm outside without an outlet and my battery is low, so I don't want to get us in trouble. I'm following very closely what's going on with the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the budget resolution. So we're taping on Thursday, August 19th. Pelosi has queued up a House rule vote for Monday, followed by a vote on the budget resolution on Tuesday. That's what I've seen reported. You have 9 House moderates who have said in an open letter to Pelosi that they will not vote for the budget resolution until the bipartisan infrastructure bill is signed into law. And the budget resolution is non-binding, but a precursor to having a budget reconciliation bill that is filibuster-proof and can handle Democrats' broader, non-traditional infrastructure agenda. And I have made the point that these 9 have considerable leverage. They hold good cards, and the only thing that would deny them that leverage is if they stand down themselves, if they fold. I'm not predicting that they won't fold, but I don't see why they would. I don't see what they would get out of it. I mean, Pelosi obviously could theoretically offer them certain concessions. I just don't know what those concessions could be, short of what they have unequivocally asked for. I've got a fair amount of pushback on Twitter from certain columnists, either someone implicitly. No one's called me out a name in print yet, but some of the people that are in my Twitter feed yell me have written columns suggesting I'm not crediting Pelosi with enough savvy and strength, that these 9 are outgunned by the larger progressive contingent that says they won't do the opposite. They won't vote for the infrastructure bill before reconciliation passes, at least passes the Senate. And so I'm out to lunch. And I feel a little gaslit. So I want to be clear. You know, I'm not making a flat prediction. I can't know what the 9 are going to do at the end of, when it's crunch time. But this is what I understand. And if I'm getting something wrong here, you know, call me out.
Now you're sounding like Obama.
What Pelosi has done is made a rule. Now in the House, in the Senate, it's a cloture vote before moving to final vote. You have a cloture vote to start debate, then a cloture vote to end debate and move to a final vote. In the House, you have a rule. It's passed in the Rules Committee. It puts a bill on the floor calendar, which the Speaker can then take things off the floor calendar and put them on the floor. You have a floor debate. You have a final vote. Just because it's on the floor calendar doesn't require Pelosi to take it off the calendar, let alone the order in which she takes things off the calendar. So after the House moderates, these 9 moderates made their threat, Pelosi crafted a rule that includes putting the budget resolution, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and the bipartisan infrastructure bill, that all 3 are in the rule, and would put them all on the calendar. And what has been reported is Pelosi plans that votes for Monday, that on Tuesday, Pelosi is going to take the resolution, the budget resolution, and the voting rights bill, and put those on the floor, but not the infrastructure bill. Now, I've seen it reported in places that the rule is some big test for the moderates. But as far as I can tell, it's the opposite. The rule helps the moderates. The rule cues up the infrastructure bill to be put on the floor whenever the Speaker feels like it. Now, she doesn't feel like it today. So she says. But if the moderates follow through on their threat and they block the resolution, and mind you, Pelosi has been berating them implicitly, saying this is not amateur hour, that we're never going to sacrifice our leverage on reconciliation. And so I have people coming to my feet saying, the pressure's on. pull us where the pressure on. And I'm like, this, I'm not that, I mean, you know, Matt, you know I'm a Pelosi stan. You know I stood for Pelosi, would know I stand for Pelosi. So
you have a poster of her hanging up in your bedroom.
I 100% respect Pelosi's parliamentary skill and political acumen. But saying, this is amateur hour, that's not pressure. Why would that make anybody move? In fact, I think Pelosi knows it's not going to make anybody move quite. I mean, it's just my opinion, speculation, but I think she knows that's not how this really works. So if it doesn't move the nine and they vote against the resolution on Tuesday, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen in a heartbeat, but if it becomes evident that they're not going to move, Pelosi has queued up the bipartisan infrastructure bill. She can say, hey, guys, I tried, man. I called an amateur hour. I put the resolution on the floor. The White House is with me. I pounded my fist on the table. These guys just ain't moving. What are we going to do? All we can do here is get the infrastructure bill passed and move on to the resolution to reconciliation after that. Again, I'm not saying that is what's going to happen, but I think she has put these chess pieces in place so that could happen. And if so, if I'm in the moderate nine, why would I vote against the rule? This queues up the infrastructure bill. And you know, just what makes me unnerved is that, you know, why doesn't anybody else say this? What am I getting wrong? Am I missing something here? So I'm missing something.
If you're watching this and you're an expert on parliamentary procedure, let us know in the comment.
Feel free. If I'm wrong,
but
I'm wrong.
Weigh in, Bill. I'm not an expert. I could tell you my opinion. Not an expert. I don't want to speculate, but someone out there probably is.
Now, you know, people, I think, rightly have pointed out to me, you know, Pelosi doesn't put things on the floor that she's going to lose on. I mean, it may well be she doesn't actually have the vote in the resolution. If the votes are there, she might just say, I call off the vote. But we do have this example from 2009 when she said, the House is not going to pass a bill without a robust public option in Obamacare. And they passed the bill with a public option. Now, some said it wasn't robust. Kucinich voted against it initially because he said this is not a robust public option. And then it went to the Senate, and the Senate said, sorry, no public option for you. And then when even there was an attempt for a reconciliation bill as a follow-up. You might remember this, Matt. There was a second sort of bill that kind of touched things up after Scott Brown took over the 60th vote in the Senate, and now the threshold had dropped from 60 to 50, and some progressives were like, now's the time to slip in public option. We don't need 60. And the Senate said, nope, still don't have it. And Pelosi said, sorry, kids, it makes me very sad. We tried really hard, but now we got to pass something without public option in it. So she is capable of that pivot. I don't think it means that she's weak. It just means I think she knows how to count heads. Now, so here's another aspect here that is fuzzy. So why would it be that nine moderates have more power than, as what one anonymous person said, dozens and dozens of progressives who won't do the opposite? You have a Congressional Progressive Caucus letter in which Congresswoman Jayapal, Porter, and Omar say, we did a survey of our 96 Congressional Progressive Caucus members, and a majority of the respondents said, we're not going to vote for the infrastructure bill before the Senate passes reconciliation. Now, first, this survey was taken before the moderate nine threat. So maybe things change. What strikes me as very weird about this whole situation is, why don't we have a hard number? They said a majority of our respondents. Well, how many people responded? All 96 or less? If they responded in a way that you find favorable, who are they? Why aren't they public? Where are their names? Why aren't they signing this letter? So when the moderate nine threat happened, we heard from an anonymous senior Democratic aide that there are dozens and dozens. Well, where are they? I'm not saying that people haven't said this privately, but, you know, private pledges don't always remain so in the sunlight. So that's one thing I find strange. Secondly, the moderates and the progressives are on different game boards. The moderates want to block the budget resolution for the time being. That's a party line vote. There are 220 Democrats. There's some vacancies. A majority right now is 217. So they can lose 3, it's 11 majority. Moderates have 9. They can block that. The bipartisan infrastructure bill, if it was put on the floor, that's not automatically a party line vote. There are Republicans who say they're going to vote for that. We don't know how many. Same standard I put on the Progressive Caucus I do on the Problem Solvers Caucus. Brian Fitzpatrick, the Republican co-chair, has said they're enough. Well, what is enough? We don't. The progressives don't know what's enough because they don't know how many Republicans there are, and the Republicans don't know how many there is enough because they don't know how many progressives there are. There's some other anonymous source that told The Hill that there are up to 40 Republicans who will vote for this thing as a standalone. But again, I don't know what those names are. I'm just saying it's a possibility. So the moderate nine have clear leverage. We know they have the numbers if they stand their ground. We don't know if there is 217 in hand for a bipartisan bill and what it would take to prevent 217. So that just makes the progressive position, you know, fuzzier and weaker, in my opinion. So that's what I know.
Yeah. Convinced me. I mean, I think the way it probably plays out is you end up passing the bipartisan bill first. And then I guess it's a question of whether you pass the human infrastructure bill, but it's not going to be, you know, the trillions of dollars that they want it to be, right? I mean, it's going to be a smaller amount if it does pass.
Well, here's what I also find strange. So 9 House moderates, Kyrsten Sinema by herself, have the leverage to prevent $3.5 trillion because budget reconciliation is a party-line vote. And they've all communicated they think that is – I mean, Sinema has been flatly unequivocal on it. The other ones have made general indications they think it's too much. They already can do that. They don't have to do this dance to have that leverage. Now, if you're a progressive, to be fair to the progressives here, they recognize that and say, look, what can we do to counter – that leverage that already exists? Well, if we hold the bipartisan bill hostage, they can't hold the reconciliation bill hostage. We're now even Steven. And what I think that misses is to the House moderates. Many of these people are in vulnerable districts. They're worried about re-election in 2022. What's the play on every purple district incumbent, Republican or Democrat? Congressperson X votes with the party 90%+ of the time. Every party does that ad when it's their turn. They want a standalone bipartisan bill to try to inoculate themselves from that attack. And if you link the bipartisan infrastructure bill with reconciliation, it's no longer a clean bipartisan bill. So the progressives think they can say, you want this bipartisan bill and you can't get it by cutting down reconciliation if we hold it hostage. But it's no longer as prized for the average moderate if you have linked it. So that gives the moderates, in my opinion, you know, again, I don't, maybe they see it differently. Maybe they're not going to follow through in this way. But I think they have incentive to say, no, we demand this be an independent standalone bill, and we have the numbers to make that happen.
Yeah. You know, because of your argument, I think they should rename it the Moderate 10.
Well, I'm using Mod 9. That's my Twitter handle, Mod 9. Now, here's one other weird thing that I want to add here. Jonathan Chait and some others have said, you know, these moderates, they have sort of illegitimate motive. They're shilling for their donors. Gottheimer wants to raise the salt cap, or actually eliminate the salt cap altogether.
What's that?
State and local tax deduction. So it used to be that whatever you paid in your state and local taxes, you could deduct off your federal taxes. A cap was put on that in the Trump tax reform. Some progressives like that because it's really taken advantage of by middle-class households. But if you're in New York, New Jersey, California, higher tax states, those folks say, look, this is unfair. We're doing our due diligence to have a robust progressive government, and now we're getting penalized for it. So we think that cap should be lifted or, you know, in part or limited altogether. So Gottheimer wants that, and Jim Costa wants some carve-out in capital gain tax reform that Biden wants to protect family farms, which some people think is really just a shill for other wealthy estates. At least in the case of Gottheimer, he has a 33-member bipartisan salt caucus that has enough Democrats to have leverage. they got Bernie in the Senate to put salt cap relief in the Senate budget resolution already. He can't get salt relief without resolution. That's the vehicle for it. So there's no point for him to hold it up when that he's already has the preliminary win on that. So that doesn't add up for me. And the case of, you know, Costa, I mean, again, a little bit more incentive there, but he has 13 Democrats in his group for that thing. So he has that leverage already. So I don't see what they gain from this standoff. They have the numbers to exact leverage already. And so it's all these data points that I feel like other people aren't synthesizing because they have animus towards the moderate nine, just think they're chumps, and think Pelosi is a magician. And look, again, I love Pelosi, but she's not an ideologue. She's a pragmatist, and she has done things to protect the moderates before and used her sharp elbows against the left. So again, I can't know, but to assume that's going to go one way, I think the pieces don't line up there for me.
I'm inclined to believe Bill Scheer. It's my bias, but we'll have to see how it plays out. When do you think when will we know something?
Well, I mean, the plan is I think the rule is going to pass. I think it helps the moderates to pass that rule. I don't think it's going to be able to. So if you see people say, aha, the moderates voted with Pelosi, don't buy that. Unless there's something that I said that's factually wrong, and I'll correct myself if I did. My understanding is the rule helps the moderates. It's the Tuesday vote with the resolutions on the floor. That's crunch time. And we'll see what the moderates do then.
All right. Well, follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. Check out my interview with Bill Kristol at Matt Lewis and the News on iTunes. And Bill, what should they, what do you want to plug?
Well, check out my recent pieces at the Monthly, both on these two questions on the Afghanistan politics and the moderate nine's leverage. Check those out. And we'll have more to talk about on this subject next week.
Indeed. We'll see you back here.
And we'll DM Zoom tomorrow?
I don't know about that.
Okay.
I think I'm off.
Okay.
Are you going to be, will this be week four of Bill of vacation?
No. I'm back home Saturday.
You'll be back home. Okay. We'll see you back here in a week in the DMZ.
Okay. Take care.